Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There is, get a load of this, a budget deal in Washington, and yes, I did just say that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, presenting T. Rowe Price Connections, an online series exploring emerging opportunities from Africa to robotics. And by Reputation.com, with new tools to help businesses and professionals measure and manage online reviews as well as search results. Learn more at 1-800-REPUTATION.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 10th of December. Good, as always, to have you with us. I'm not sure when the last time the phrase budget deal was said in Washington, D.C. with a positive connotation, but that is, in fact, where we find ourselves today. Senator Patty Murray, chairwoman of the Senate Finance Committee, and Paul Ryan, who chairs the House Budget Committee, seem to have found some common ground. Marketplace's David Gura is on the story for us. He's on the line from Washington. Hey, David.
Hey, Kai.
So nuts and bolts aside, this is basically about the sequester, right? Those arbitrary budget cuts from a year ago?
That's right. So this is a pretty narrow deal. Nobody here is talking about a grand bargain. That next round of sequestration cuts, as they're called, were supposed to take effect in mid-January, around January 15th. This is a deal that would head those off. It would raise military spending over the next 2 years. It would raise domestic spending over the next 2 years. And in exchange for that, we'd see some cuts. I'd rather see some changes to airline fees. Those would go up. And federal employees, for instance, would have to contribute a bit more to their pensions. So it's not raising taxes, but again, it's a way to get out of those cuts that were scheduled to take effect next year.
All right. Here, I want to play a piece of tape from Congressman Ryan from this presser that ended not all that long ago.
I think this agreement is a clear improvement on the status quo. This agreement makes sure that we don't have a government shutdown scenario in January. It makes sure that we don't have another government shutdown scenario in October. It makes sure that we don't lurch from crisis to crisis.
In essence, both he and Senator Murray said the chaos is over. Really?
for the time being, at least, and it gets us through the holidays and through January and even through October of next year. So, as you said at the beginning, I mean, it's more of a deal than we've seen in a while. But, you know, it's worth noting there's a lot that's not in this bill. Again, it's pretty finely focused here on those sequestration cuts.
Well, let's explore for a second what's not in this bill. The first thing that comes to mind is long-term unemployment benefits for 1.3 million people that are going to go away come the end of the year. That's nowhere in this thing.
That's right. I mean, those were left out, and maybe there's some hope among some that that'll be dealt with before the holidays. I think that the chances of that are getting smaller and smaller. So those aren't in there. Those are important to a lot of people, obviously. We've got a farm bill that still hasn't been written or passed. And on top of that, we've got, I think there were a lot of people who were hoping, as I said, this would be a grander bargain. More would be in here relating to Medicare and Social Security. None of that is in this.
Talk to me about timing for a second here, David. The House leaves, they want to leave for the year on Friday. This still does have to pass both chambers, right? Do you see any real way that doesn't happen?
So these two budget chairmen wanted to get this done tonight for that reason alone, that they could get this to the House floor by Thursday. So the hope is that would happen in the House. It would go on to the Senate maybe later this week, early next week. There are already conservative groups that have come out against this plan even before they've read it. So the real challenge will be, I would say, tomorrow morning when this is presented to the House Republicans. We've obviously seen the fractures there over these last few months. We'll see if they buy into this plan. We'll also see if Democrats can think that this is something that they can support.
Quickly, as long as we're talking about tomorrow morning, we got about 25 seconds left. Which is more significant for Wall Street on this deal? Is it the actual dollar figures, or is it the fact that there is some methodology to making government work again?
I don't think it's the dollar figures. I think that it's the methodology. I think it's returning to regular order, as people say here,
right,
going back to a process, going back to a system. That's what the markets, I think, are going to like, is that sense of certainty.
All right, David Gura in Washington for us on the budget deal, just breaking this afternoon. David, thank you so much.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you on Wall Street today, as long as we were talking about it. Yeah, not so good. Details, numbers, you know the drill. We'll be right back. There are, as of this writing, 22 women running Fortune 500 companies. Come next month, there's going to be one more. General Motors announced this morning Mary Barra will take over as CEO on the 15th of January. She'll be the first woman to run an American car maker and steps in just as GM gets out from under its government bailout. Marketplace's David Weinberg has the story, which really isn't about Mary Barra being a woman at all.
There's no doubt GM needed the bailout. It had a reputation for designing cars that few Americans wanted. But the much-needed taxpayer money came with a great gnashing of teeth because there were strings attached.
Big bonuses were frowned upon in a big way.
Jack Nerad is the executive editorial director at Kelley Blue Book. He says now that GM is out from under the thumb of the U.S. government, it can raise executive compensation, which could help it attract top talent. And the hiring of Mary Barra, a lifelong GM employee, is another sign that normalcy is returning to GM.
This returns the company to the way it operated during its heyday.
Or
you could also look at it as a return to the kind of management that got it into the problems that led to its bankruptcy.
GM most recently has had CEOs with financial backgrounds, ending with the most recent Dan Ackerson, who's stepping down. These top executives saw cars as just another financial instrument, says Nerad.
Mary Barra has certainly exhibited an affection for automobiles and understands automobiles in a much deeper way than the typical business executive would. So I think that bodes well because it is a product-driven industry.
Today at the Detroit Athletic Club, finalists for the North American Car and Truck of the Year were announced. GM had 6 of the 24 entries.
That's huge. Ford has none. And I fully expect that they'll be finalists and probably winners.
Edmunds analyst Michelle Krebs spoke to me from the Detroit Athletic Club. 3 of GM's vehicles ended up among the 6 finalists. Krebs says GM is doing what other successful automakers have done for decades, offer compact, fuel-efficient cars.
You know, General Motors and Detroit automakers were never known for building great small cars, but they are now.
I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Shares of GM today, by the way, followed the herd on Wall Street off about 1% or so. Much of greater Washington, D.C. was shut down today for what turned out to be not all that much snow in the end. But financial regulators were on the job all the same, and they delivered to us the long-awaited Volcker Rule, the part of the Dodd-Frank financial reform law that is supposed to control some of the risks that banks take when trading with their own money. The rule itself clocks in at about 70 pages or so, but there is a preamble that goes, 850, maybe 900 pages, and therein lies the magic. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Big banks aren't saying much about the final Volcker rule. They just told us they were reviewing it. What does that mean? Lots of work for lots of lawyers, like Oliver Ireland, who's holed up in snowy Washington, getting acquainted with the rule, bit by bit.
I will spiral into the rule.
Ireland is a partner at Morrison & Forrester and has lots of bank clients. As he spirals in over the next few days, Ireland will search for what some call loopholes. He prefers to call them exclusions.
I'm going to be looking for things that it's not covering and where it was probably too broad to begin with.
Things like what kind of bank trades the rule applies to. It's designed to keep banks out of the kind of trouble that helped cause the financial crisis. But at the same time, regulators didn't want to crimp the financial markets or make it more expensive to borrow money. So they made the rules really flexible. Joel Telpner is a partner at Jones Day. He says this flexibility is essential.
These issues are so complicated that it's impossible for regulators to anticipate every concern that's going to arise.
Critics say that flexibility was baked into the rule by bank lobbyists. Lobbyists and lawyers aren't the only ones poring over thick stacks of paper today. Marcus Stanley is with the consumer group Americans for Financial Reform.
If you open this rule just to any random page, you're going to see words like reasonable, as necessary, words that require judgment by the regulators.
Stanley says there need to be limits on just how flexibly the rules are implemented. Otherwise, he says, banks will find loopholes and, in his words, blast them wide open. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
There are changes aplenty today at the yoga apparel giant Lululemon. Chairman and founder Dennis Chip Wilson is going to step down. CEO Christine Day will be replaced by Laurent Potdevin, who was until recently the CEO of Tom's Shoes. And yes, this is the same Lululemon of the transparent yoga pants from a couple of months ago. And you might also recall Dennis Wilson saying some women's bodies just aren't made for Lululemon pants. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the company story.
Lululemon is a little different from other retailers, says Candice Corlett, president of WSL Strategic Retail.
This is about a culture, a mindset. And I think their brilliance was being able to tap into that mindset and nurture it for so long.
That mindset of health, wellness, and other things.
Brian Tracy CDs were huge. Good to Great was on the book club list.
Elizabeth Likrish is a writer. She worked at Lululemon in 2011 while attending grad school. She was surprised by some of the material the company encouraged her to read.
It culminated in Atlas Shrugged, which nobody had read. Nobody had read Ayn Rand, but you would mention her and their eyes would kind of glaze over. And they'd say, oh, Ayn Rand and objectivism and yeah, we believe.
Likrish says employees were also encouraged to join Landmark, a well-known series of self-help seminars, and that there was a lot of pressure put on eating right and taking the company's free fitness classes.
That sounds great, but that kind of translates to, like, pressure to go to CrossFit at 5:30 in the morning before you work all day.
Likrish says customers felt the pressure, too. She says the store didn't treat plus-size customers very well. I called Lululemon to ask about this, but they didn't respond. John Horan is with Sporting Good Intelligence. He says Lululemon's strong corporate culture inspires employees. But when that starts to get exclusionary, it's bad for business.
At times, these corporate cultures can run amok, and I think maybe a little of that happened with Lululemon.
Horan says the culture and brand image need some remodeling, but there's a lot of good there.
They have terrific people in the stores, people who really are committed to the brand and to the products, and that's the upside of their culture.
Horan says the new CEO needs to be careful not to throw the baby out with the transparent yoga pants. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up.
There's a lot to getting a great blowout. It doesn't just happen.
The business of professional blow drying, which is, as it turns out, a thing. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, well, here you go. The Dow Industrials deflated itself 52 points today. About a 3% closed at 15,973. Yes, that is 16,000 in the rearview mirror. The NASDAQ deleted 8 points, 0.2%, wrapped at 4,060. The S&P 500 ticked down 5 points, about a 3%, finished at 1,802. If you somehow figured a cross-country cold snap meant gangbuster sales for Burlington Coat Factory, not so fast. Burlington stores pulled nearly 8% off the rack today after a disappointing profit report, the store's first since its October IPO. Toll Brothers beat profit estimates, but tore off 0.7%. Today, the home builder says, CEO says the economy, while still improving, is far from fully recovered. Campbell's Soup spilled 3.75%. Starbucks dumped nearly 3% today. The Volcker Rule didn't shake financials too terribly much. Morgan Stanley gained about 1.25%. J.P. Morgan Chase added 0.3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.8% on the nose. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Burst, cloud business analytics engineered to turn data into knowledge. Burst lets companies think fast. Learn more at BIRST.com. Burst, think fast. By Allianz, serving more than 78 million customers worldwide and providing retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S., AllianzUSA.com. And by Slacker Radio, delivering handcrafted streaming radio to the web, smartphones, and tablets with over 13 million songs and talk programs, including Marketplace. More at slacker.com. Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
on the Marketplace Datebook. Here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, a memorial service for former South African President Nelson Mandela takes place at the National Cathedral. The Treasury Department issues its monthly statement for November. And let's plan ahead. Get a jump start on your New Year's resolution. Uncle Sam has collected a list of popular choices at USA.gov. Among them, manage stress, save money, and volunteer to help others. And get fit, of course. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The year-end flood of requests for charitable contributions is in full swing. And while the specifics of each individual pitch may vary, the common thread goes something like this. Hey, it's all for a good cause, right? So please, give. Truth is, philanthropy has its critics, especially big philanthropy. So today on our series, A Lot to Give, wealth and poverty reporter Noelle King asks what could possibly be wrong with giving money away.
The first criticism of philanthropy dates back to the first philanthropist.
I am Prometheus, who gave fire to man.
The term philanthropist means lover of humanity. It was coined by the Greek playwright Aeschylus for the mythological titan who stole fire from the gods. Furious, the gods chained him to a rock for eternity.
Far from all human company, with metal bonds impossible to break. This is the fruit of your philanthropy!
Prometheus Bound was staged at the Getty Museum by Travis Preston and the CalArts Center for New Performance. Modern philanthropy doesn't come with such severe consequences, but big gifts can be controversial. There's this thing called the $1 million list. Indiana University's Lilly Family School of Philanthropy tracks publicly announced donations of $1 million or more.
Okay, I'm on just one page of the $1 million list, and the first thing that jumps out is there are a lot of elite colleges and universities here. The University of Chicago, Yale, MIT. There are a number of health-related causes, and then there are lots of arts organizations. The Metropolitan Museum of Art seems to get a lot of gifts.
Una Osili is lead researcher of the $1 million list and of a 2012 study on high net worth philanthropy. She says wealthy people give a lot to education. And during the recession, they gave more to things like food banks and homeless shelters. But compared to less wealthy people,
high net worth donors give perhaps disproportionately when you compare them to the average American household to arts and culture institutions ranging from museums, music, performance.
Critics say rich people donate a lot to their own elite world of symphonies and fancy colleges.
It is a realm in which if you give enough money, you get things named after you, like museums, buildings on college campuses.
Robert F. Dalzell is author of The Good Rich and What They Cost Us. He says when the rich give, they also take.
They get handsomely rewarded by tax deductions, and that means there is a financial and social cost to society.
Last year, around $50 billion that would have gone to the U.S. Treasury in taxes was refunded under the charitable tax deduction. So individuals decided how to spend that $50 billion rather than our democratic government. The tax deduction is controversial, but for the moment, it's staying put. And it's the same whether you give to or to kids who survived that devastating typhoon in the Philippines.
Are you hungry?
Yes.
Do you have any food?
No.
Which bugs a second group of critics. They say some causes are simply more worthy than others. Peter Singer is a professor of bioethics at Princeton and author of The Life You Can Save. He thinks we should give to the poorest, most vulnerable people.
I'm concerned with essentially getting the most bang for your buck.
I mentioned that Princeton, his employer, gets a lot of big gifts. It's on the $1 million list 144 times.
Well, in the broadcasting studio I'm sitting in happens to be in a very expensive building, the Lewis Library, that was donated with money from an alumni, Peter Lewis. I believe it cost $80 million. I think Princeton actually coped quite well without having this building.
And when I tell him I'm planning a trip to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, on the $1 million list 81 times, he offers a challenge. He wants to fight a disease called trachoma.
If you're talking to people from the Met, I'd suggest you put this example to them. $45 million could prevent 1 million people becoming blind. Recently, they spent $45 million to buy a painting by the Sienese painter Duccio. I've seen it there. It's a small Madonna. It's a nice painting.
I wanted to see that painting.
The Virgin Mary is wearing green and gold robes, and the baby Jesus is wearing sort of a red onesie, and he's reaching up toward his mother's face. It's a beautiful painting, to be sure.
I took Singer's argument that the money spent on beautiful paintings would be better spent on human suffering to Emily Rafferty, president of the Met.
A human being needs to be nourished, and that's partially in body, but it's also in mind and in soul. The day after 9/11, when we were asked by the city to open, we had thousands of people waiting outside the Met's front door, thousands of them. And when they came in, they looked around, they went to the galleries, they went to their favorite work of art. It was a way that they could affirm their continuing existence and the fact that history had preceded them and there was survival.
This question of what is worth giving to is one that every philanthropist faces. From the one who gives millions to the one writing a $10 check. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Tomorrow on the program, the edge that philanthropy can have sometimes over government when it comes to solving problems. Our series, A Lot to Give, lives online. It's at marketplace.org. I've got one of those jobs where you learn something every single day. You just open your mind and you let the knowledge flow in. Still, when I heard about this next story, I just didn't get it. A chain of hair salons at which there is no cutting, no coloring, just blow drying. The dry bar, as it's called, is the brainchild, the very successful brainchild, it should be said, of a professional stylist named Allie Webb and her brother Michael. Hey, how are you?
Hey, how are you?
I'm Kai. Nice to see you.
Nice to meet you.
How are you?
Hi, Allie.
Hi, Allie.
Nice
how
to meet
are you?
You?
So tell me where we are. Because really, I've never been in a place like this before. It'll shock you to know.
Well, this is our this is going to be our 34th location and our, I think, 12th or 13th here in Los Angeles. This is a dry bar where there's no cuts, no color, just blowouts.
I have to tell you that when this story was pitched to me, I don't understand it.
Michael didn't understand it either when I first came to him with this idea, also being bald.
We should point out that Michael has no hair.
Yeah, you have good hair.
It's been said.
I'm jealous.
So here's the thing I don't understand about this. You could go to Rite Aid and spend $35 and get a perfectly good blow dryer and spend 8-10 minutes in the bathroom after you shower, boom,
oh,
and you're done.
No. That's where you're wrong. But that's exactly what Michael thought, too.
Yeah.
He was like, what do you mean? I see my wife blow dry her hair all the time. Can't she do it herself? The thing is, and not being a woman, it's hard for you to understand, but any woman in this room could also explain this to you as well as I can, that you can't, most women can't do their hair as, the majority of women can't do their hair as well as a professional can. They can attempt to.
I grant you that. Totally grant you that.
So, first of all, 10 minutes is definitely not going to do the trick. I mean, it takes us 35 to 45 minutes.
No, come on.
Yeah, no,
really?
True. You have to, there's a lot to getting a great blowout. It doesn't just happen. And it will last you for days so that you don't have to worry about it in the morning. You can go 2-4 days without having to do anything to your hair, which when you have kids is a really nice thing.
Talk to me about the business proposition here. You had this idea. So let's back up. So you're
driving
around
giving
all your mommy friends blowouts.
So I'm driving around. I had this mobile blow dry business. Michael, who's, you know, always been my brother and biggest fan and supporter, kind of was watching from the sidelines this little business that was growing. And I got to the point where I was having to say no all the time. I didn't have enough time for all the demand I had. So I went to Michael and I said, you know, I think instead of me doing this mobily, that I should open a place, a shop, a salon where all we do are blowouts. Instead of me going to them, they come to me. And so again, Michael thought I was kind of crazy and didn't understand why I wouldn't want to do cuts and color, because that's where the real money was.
Right.
But I explained to him, like I explained to you, that, you know, women felt really great when they got a blowout. And I felt like if the price point was right, they would come in frequently, not for just events, not, you know, it was cost prohibitive before dry bar.
And here's where Allie, and so I lent her the money. I thought I'd never see it again.
How much did you lend her?
$250,000. She's my sister, and I love her. And we did the math. Like, wait, this is the funny part.
It's a lot of love, man.
We did the math, and we felt that in order for Allie to make a nice little living and to support herself, and she had to do 20 or 30 blowouts a day. But now we, you know, most of our stores average well over 100 blowouts a day. So we just really underestimated the demand.
So what you have here is a blowout factory, right? Kinda,
right?
A little. It's a little assembly line.
It's very personal.
I get that. And
don't say factory.
But let's set the branding aside and just think about what you got. Right? It's a little bit of a machine, right? I mean, you have, in order to scale, which you're doing at 34, 35 stores.
Yeah.
You have to be able to routinize some of this stuff.
Well, we do have a lot of training in place, and it's gotten more and more robust over the years as we've grown. And there is really a dry bar way. There is a way that we blow out hair.
It's like HP. It's like Hewlett Packard, the dry bar way.
There is. And I get stylists who've been doing hair for, 10 years, and they come in and they're like, oh, I didn't know you could blow out like this. I didn't know you could get curl with a brush and not in a curling iron. I know that's completely out of your scope.
What?
But there's a lot of things that we teach stylists that they, about blow drying hair, there is really an art to it.
You're somebody now in the hair world.
Well, thanks.
Right? No, I mean, come on, own it. You got to own it.
Yeah, I mean, it's been very surreal and very humbling. I mean, when people say things to me like, we've disrupted this industry and we've changed it, and I think it's so crazy, but it's really exciting. I mean, I feel like I'm like living the dream, and I feel so lucky.
It's become a much bigger business than any of us expected.
Allie Webb and her brother Michael Landau at Dry Bar number 34 opens for business tomorrow.
Marketplace is supported by Join Me, an instant online meeting app used by millions of people to collaborate and get work done anywhere. More at join.me. By United Healthcare, with information on doctors, treatment options, and cost estimates for patients to make educated health decisions. Online at uhc.com. And by Brandware, helping companies uncover fresh information about their brands through a custom combination of research, thought leadership, and public relations. Learn more at brandware.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
These final notes today, yes, two for one, just because. Item the first, forget public radio t-shirts. What we need is a good public radio calendar. New York City taxi drivers are all over that one. $14.99 is the sticker price for pictures of genuine cabbies in Come Hither poses. Yes, it's a spoof, but proceeds benefit a social services group down in Lower Manhattan. Item number two, before which I must confess I actually did watch a good part of The Sound of Music on television the other night, but that's beside the point. From the pages of the New York Times today, this item, Bob Greenblatt, the head of NBC's entertainment unit, says thanks to the BAFO ratings for Carrie Underwood and cast, the network is going to do another live show next year. Family-friendly is what he's looking for, he said, with lots of familiar songs. So tweet us your suggestions, casting recommendations, too, if you got them. At Marketplace APM is the show. At Kai Rizdahl is me. Also, before we go, I said before that Patty Murray chaired the Senate Finance Committee. She doesn't. It's the Senate Budget Committee that she runs. All right, with that correction, that's it. That's Marketplace from APM. Nancy Fargali, John Ketchum, and Kenneth Manriquez are the producers on our Marketplace desks. I am Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.